1,000. He should have said, "Don't worry, the chances are better than 10 out of 11 that you are not infected." In my case, the screening test was apparently fooled by certain markers that were present in my blood, even though the virus this test was screening for was not present. It is important to know the false positive rate when assessing any diagnostic test. For example, a test that identifies 99% of all malignant tumors sounds very impressive. But I can easily devise a test that identifies 100% of all tumors. All I have to do is report that everyone I examine has a tumor. The key statistic that differentiates my test from the useful one is that my test will produce a high rate of false positives. But this incident illustrates that knowledge of the false positive rate is not sufficient to determine the usefulness of a test. You must also know how the false positive rate compares with the true prevalence of the disease. If the disease is rare, even a low false positive rate does not mean that a positive test implies you have the disease. If a disease is common, a positive result is much more likely to be meaningful. To see how the true prevalence affects the implications of a positive test, let's suppose now that I had been homosexual and tested positive. Assume that in the male gay community, the chance of infection among those being tested in 1989 was about 1%. That means that in the results of 10,000 tests, we would not find one, as before, but 100 true positives to go with the 10 false positives. So in this case, the chances that a positive test meant I was infected would have been 10 out of 11. That's why, when assessing test results, it is good to know whether you are in a high-risk group. Bayes' theory shows that the probability that A will occur if B occurs will generally differ from the probability that B will occur if A occurs. Do not account for this as a common mistake in the medical profession. For instance, in studies in Germany and the United States, researchers asked physicians to estimate the probability that an asymptomatic woman between the ages of 40 and 50 who has a positive mammogram actually has breast cancer if 7% of mammograms show cancer when there is none. In addition, the doctors were told that the actual incidence was about 0.8% and that the false negative rate about 10%. Putting that all together, one can use Bayes' methods to determine that a positive mammogram is due to cancer in only about 9% of the cases. In the German group, however, one-third of the physicians concluded that the probability was about 90%, and the median estimate was 70%. In the American group, 95 out of 100 physicians estimated the probability to be around 75%. Similar issues arise in drug testing in athletes. Here again, the oft-quoted but not directly relevant number is the false positive rate. This gives a distorted view of the probability that an athlete is guilty. For example, Mary Decker Slaney, a world-class runner and 1983 world champion in the 1500 and 3000-meter race, was trying to make a comeback when, at the U.S. Olympic trials in Atlanta in 1996, she was accused of doping violations consistent with testosterone use. After various deliberations, the IAAF, known officially since 2001 as the International Association of Athletics Federations, ruled that Slaney was guilty of a doping offense, effectively ending her career. According to some of the testimony in the Slaney case, the false positive rate for the test to which her urine was subjected could have been as high as 1%. This probably made many people comfortable that her chance of guilt was 99%, but, as we have seen, that is not true. Suppose, for example, 1,000 athletes were tested. 1 in 10 was guilty, and the test, when given to a guilty athlete, had a 50% chance of revealing the doping violation. Then for every 1,000 athletes tested, 100 would have been guilty, and the test would have fingered 50 of those. Meanwhile, of the 900 athletes who are innocent, the test would have fingered 9. So what a positive doping test really meant was not that the probability she was guilty was 99%, but rather 50 out of 59 equaling 84.7%. Put another way, you should have about as much confidence that Slaney was guilty based on that evidence as you would that the number one wouldn't turn up when she tossed a die. That certainly leaves room for reasonable doubt, and more important, indicates that to perform mass testing, 90,000 athletes have their urine tested annually, and make judgments based on such a procedure means to condemn a large number of innocent people. In legal circles, the mistake of inversion is sometimes called the prosecutor's fallacy, because prosecutors often employ that type of fallacious argument to lead juries to convicting suspects on thin evidence. Consider, for example, the case in Britain of Sally Clark. Clark's first child died at 11 weeks. The death was reported as due to sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, a diagnosis that is made when the death of a baby is unexpected and a postmortem does not reveal a cause of death. Clark conceived again, and this time her baby died at 8 weeks, again reportedly of SIDS. When that happened, she was arrested and accused of smothering both children. At the trial, the prosecution called in an expert pediatrician, Sir Roy Meadow, to testify that based on the rarity of SIDS, the odds of both children's dying from it was 73 million to one. The prosecution offered no other substantive evidence against her. Should that have been enough to convict? The jury thought so, and in November 1999, Mrs. Clark was sent to prison. Sir Meadow had estimated that the odds that a child will die of SIDS are 1 in 8,543. He calculated his estimate of 73 million to 1 by multiplying two such factors, one for each child. But this calculation assumes that the deaths are independent, that is, that no environmental or genetic effects play a role that might increase a second child's risk once an older sibling has died of SIDS. In fact, in an editorial in the British Medical Journal a few weeks after the trial, the chances of two siblings dying of SIDS was estimated at 2.75 million to 1. Those are still very long odds. The key to understanding why Sally Clark was wrongly imprisoned is again to consider the inversion error. It is not the probability that two children will die of SIDS that we seek, but the probability that the two children who died, died of SIDS. 2 years after Clark was imprisoned, the Royal Statistical Society weighed in on this subject with a press release, declaring that the jury's decision was based on a serious error of logic, known as the prosecutor's fallacy. The jury needs to weigh up two competing explanations for the baby's deaths, SIDS or murder. Two deaths by SIDS or two murders are each quite unlikely, but one has apparently happened in this case. What matters is the relative likelihood of the deaths, not just how unlikely the SIDS explanation is. A mathematician later estimated the relative likelihood of a family's losing two babies by SIDS or by murder. He concluded, based on the available data, that two infants are 9 times more likely to be SIDS victims than murder victims. The Clarks appealed the case, and for the appeal, hired their own statisticians as expert witnesses. They lost the appeal, but they continued to seek medical explanations for the deaths, and in the process uncovered the fact that the pathologist working for the prosecution had withheld the fact that the second child had been suffering from a bacterial infection at the time of death, an infection that might have caused the infant's death. Based on that discovery, a judge quashed the conviction, and after nearly 3.5 years, Sally Clark was released from prison. The renowned attorney and Harvard Law School professor Alan Dershowitz also successfully employed the prosecutor's fallacy to help defend O.J. Simpson in his trial for the murder of Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and a male companion. The trial of Simpson, a former football star, was one of the biggest media events of 1994-95. The police had plenty of evidence against him. They found a bloody glove at his estate that seemed to match one found at the murder scene. Bloodstains matching Nicole's blood were found on the gloves, in his white Ford Bronco, on a pair of socks in his bedroom, and in his driveway and house. Moreover, DNA samples taken from blood at the crime scene matched OJ's. The defense could do little more than accuse the Los Angeles Police Department of racism. OJ is African-American. And criticize the integrity of the police and the authenticity of their evidence. The prosecution made a decision to focus the opening of its case on OJ's propensity toward violence against Nicole. Prosecutors spent the first 10 days of the trial entering evidence of his history of abusing her and claimed that this alone was a good reason to suspect him of her murder. As they put it, a slap is a prelude to homicide. The defense attorneys used this strategy as the launchpad for their accusations of duplicity, arguing that the prosecution had spent 2 weeks trying to mislead the jury, and that the evidence that O.J. had battered Nicole on previous occasions meant nothing. Here is Dershowitz's reasoning. 4 million women are battered annually by husbands and boyfriends in the United States. Yet in 1992, according to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, a total of 1,432, or 1 in 2,500, were killed by their husbands or boyfriends. Therefore, the defense retorted, few men who slap or beat their domestic partners go on to murder them. True? Yes. Convincing? Yes. Relevant? No. The relevant number is not the probability that a man who batters his wife will go on to kill her, 1 in 2,500. But rather the probability that a battered wife who was murdered by her abuser. According to the Uniform Crime Reports for the United States and its possessions in 1993, the probability Dershowitz or the prosecution should have reported was this one. Of all the battered women murdered in the United States in 1993, some 90% were killed by their abuser. That statistic was not mentioned at the trial. As the hour of the verdict's announcement approached, long-distance call volume dropped by half. Trading volume on the New York Stock Exchange fell by 40%, and an estimated 100 million people turned to their televisions and radios to hear the verdict. Not guilty. Dershowitz may have felt justified in misleading the jury because, in his words, the courtroom oath, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, is applicable only to witnesses. Defense attorneys, prosecutors, and judges don't take this oath. Indeed, it is fair to say the American justice system is built on a foundation of not telling the whole truth. Though conditional probability represents a revolution in ideas about randomness, Thomas Bayes was no revolutionary, and his work languished unattended despite its publication in the prestigious Philosophical Transactions in 1764. And so it fell to another man, the French scientist and mathematician, Pierre-Simon de Laplace, to bring Bayes' ideas to scientists' attention and fulfill the goal of revealing to the world how the probabilities that underlie real-world situations could be inferred from the outcomes we observe. You may remember that Bernoulli's Golden Theorem will tell you before you conduct a series of coin tosses how certain you can be, if the coin is fair, that you will observe some given outcome. You may also remember that it will not tell you after you've made a given series of tosses the chances that the coin was a fair one. Along the same lines, if you know that the chances that an 85-year-old will survive to 90 are 50 out of 50, the Golden Theorem tells you the probability that half the 85-year-olds in a group of 1,000 will die in the next 5 years. But if half the people in some group died in the 5 years after their 85th birthday, it cannot tell you how likely it is that the underlying chances of survival for the people in that group were 50 over 50. Or if Ford knows that 1 in 100 of its automobiles has a defective transmission, the Golden Theorem can tell Ford the chances that, in a batch of 1,000 autos, 10 or more of the transmissions will be defective. But if Ford finds 10 defective transmissions in a sample of 1,000 autos, it does not tell the automaker the likelihood that the average number of defective transmissions is 1 in 100. In these cases, it is the latter scenario that is more often useful in life. Outside situations involving gambling, we are not normally provided with theoretical knowledge of the odds, but rather must estimate them after making a series of observations. Scientists, too, find themselves in this position. They do not generally seek to know, given the value of a physical quantity, the probability that a measurement will come out one way or another, but instead seek to discern the true value of a physical quality, given a set of measurements. I have stressed this distinction because it is an important one. It defines the fundamental difference between probability and statistics. The former concerns predictions based on fixed probabilities. The latter concerns the inference of those probabilities based on observed data. It is the latter set of issues that was addressed by Laplace. He was not aware of Bayes' theory and therefore had to reinvent it. As he framed it, the issue was this. Given a series of measurements, what is the best guess you can make of the true value of the measured quantity, and what are the chances that this guess will be near the true value, however demanding you are in your definition of near? Laplace's analysis began with a paper in 1774, but spread over 4 decades. A brilliant and sometimes generous man, he also occasionally borrowed without acknowledgement from the works of others and was a tireless self-promoter. Most important, though, Laplace was a flexible reed that bent with the breeze, a characteristic that allowed him to continue his groundbreaking work virtually undisturbed by the turbulent events transpiring around him. Prior to the French Revolution, Laplace obtained the lucrative post of examiner to the Royal Artillery, in which he had the luck to examine a promising 16-year-old candidate named Napoleon Bonaparte. When the Revolution came in 1789, he fell briefly under suspicion, but unlike many others, emerged unscathed, declaring his inextinguishable hatred to royalty, and eventually winning new honors from the Republic. Then, when his acquaintance Napoleon crowned himself emperor in 1804, he immediately shed his republicanism, and in 1806 was given the title Count. After the Bourbons returned, Laplace slammed Napoleon in the 1814 edition of his treatise, The Theory of Analytic Probabilities, writing that the fall of empires which aspire to universal dominion could be predicted with very high probability by one versed in the calculus of chance. The previous, 1812 edition, had been dedicated to Napoleon the Great. Laplace's political dexterity was fortunate for mathematics, for in the end his analysis was richer and more complete than Bayes's. With the foundation provided by Laplace's work, in the next chapter we shall leave the realm of probability and enter that of statistics. Their joining point is one of the most important curves in all of mathematics and science, the Bell curve, otherwise known as the normal distribution. That, and the new theory of measurement that came with it, are the subjects of the following chapter. Chapter 7. Measurement and the Law of Errors. One day not long ago, my son Alexei came home and announced the grade on his most recent English essay. He had received a 93. Under normal circumstances, I would have congratulated him on earning an A. And since it was a low A and I know him to be capable of better, I would have added that this grade was evidence that if he put in a little effort, he could score even higher next time. But these were not normal circumstances. And in this case, I considered the grade of 93 to be a shocking underestimation of the quality of the essay. At this point, you might think that the previous few sentences tell you more about me than